37, cabbage-looking in mufti. The story so far. After the worm-chewing outrage and Philippa Portley's continued and hysterical nausea, Hubert has been declared definitely off his chump by the Rawlinson family, with the sweet exception of great-aunt Florrie, who asseverates her brother-in-law is merely unusual, should be shown kindness, as, after all, he is well-meant and quite the bearded epitome of kindness. He is, however, ordered to eat alone, shunned, eschewed, sent to Coventry, and has his boots nailed to the floor so he can't go out. Now, think on't. A baleful, greed-glint prodigal son cast doubt and drear into Concreton estate, waking as though from the cheerless depths of a boiled cod's eye. But in Rawlinson End, towers, turrets, and each tiny nostril hair were gilded, as were Sir Henry's teeth, save the two he'd had carved in Indonesia from hardwood, inlaid with mother-of-pearl. It was very, very early, and he lay back on his bed, atrabilious and fidgety.
Get a shufti on, will you?
He pulled his face quasimodo, as old Scroton, the wrinkled retainer, more vigorously applied the boot polish to his master's head with an old gout stocking, working it in well down the neck and thorax, almost to the hirsute and gargantuan belly.
Though he still reckons would be smarter if master had let I buff it up a bit. Shiny allers looks dandy. For the umpteenth time I'm supposed to be an impecunious jungle bunny, not the bonnet of me rolls.
Scrotum, deaf as a brick wall, horse's black beauty, grinned.
Don't you worry none about them roses, master. I've been creeping out nights when them aphids is breeding. Throw a bucket of cold water over them. Don't feel like it, are that.
Of the makeup, there remained only the tufty wig and the eyes to do. Scrotum held a cork, of which Henry had a great and enjoyably planned supply, to a candle, and the room was sarabanded with curlicues of sweetish smoke. Henry's moustache, pomaded stiff and upsweeping, was almost Darwinian in corkscrew. His eyelashes and lids were now coal candle, sooty and sweep, and he clipped on a pair of huge cylindrical earrings, while Scrotum applied a little wood adhesive to his forehead to fix a green sequin. Through the sheer of Henry Rawlinson's stockings, his tumescent veins seemed Stygian spaghetti.
God's teeth! You've bought another pair with a seam up the back! Legs don't have seams!
He took a hefty swig of entre-deux legs to steady himself. This morning, he must remain tranquil as a yogi's navel. Then he tugged on a lilac knee-length tutu over his sandals, fastened it with a gay stomacher, slipped into his mirrored jacket, rammed on his turban, and was perfect.
Now creak off and check the library.
Scrotum wheezed out of the chamber, and Henry postured before the glass.
Hello, Sahib. Jumbo Bwana. Am this the correct inclination for the gibberish embassy?
He grimaced horribly.
Damn it, I look like a half-wrapped after-dinner chocolate.
Scrotum made 9 conspiratorial knocks on the bedroom door, and with a final glance to check his seams were straight, Henry padded heavily after the old man down dusty corridors and close-shut rooms wherein Rawlinson's tossed, snoozed, and dreamt of empty. Then down the back-hall staircase where heavy-framed Maynards and Rawlinsons glared from time dulled oil, strange-headed and fierce, past the billiards room and into the library. Scrotum shifted a huge button-back armchair to the wall, and standing on the arm, reached up and removed 3 books from the almost top shelf. The weighty, leather-bound Pictorial History of Gargling, Dead Men Don't Need Haircuts, and Personal Dental Experiences. These 3 revealed a lever, and with a pull, a portion of the shelving swung, protesting back, to reveal a passage.
I suggest you get this thing well-oiled. If I can manage it every day, I'm damned if I can see why the doors should stay sober.
Without even a cheerio, Henry disappeared and was soon swallowed in dark, lashing at spiderwebs with his cane, cursing quietly and kicking at the bristly things scuttling snuffly and blind at his almost naked ankles. The tunnel gave egress in a thick, wooded part of bramble patch, and after brushing himself off, Henry uncovered a well-kept, though ancient, unicycle he'd stolen from Hubert. This hidden beneath a hide of gorse. It was then he noticed the ladders Through his black stockings, great rakes revealed corpse, sunless white and mauve squid chilblain.
Lost!
Henry fiddled with his suspenders, tore off the stockings, and from his shoulder bag produced a hip flask of paraffina. A quick swig, and resentfully, he poured a little into his palm to make mud. This he smeared from toes to thighs, swearing horribly at the growing light. The mud was not dry before he checked the tire pressure and balanced against a larch for the off, cocked his leg over, and with a deep grunt and a push, pedalled wildly, teetering, uncertain gyroscope, rut, root, duck, sway, swerve, round rat hole, heading for the new tarmacadam and evil-smelling arterial road to Concreton. Hubert didn't bother with boots. Three pairs of socks, and his stilts were quite comfy. He had bells tied to the wooden ends to help him keep time as he strode. I'm tracing models in the puddles at the poodle doodle doodle on the jigsaw floor. Thank welks, they all have heads of wood. I dread the day I'm understood. Though himself soft-spoken, it made Hubert laugh to hear other people shouting. This he considered not only helpful, but might, if taken to its illogical conclusion, just do away with the hated telephone. So it was not only for speed, far-seeing and stature that he habitually went on stilts, for also he affected an ear trumpet, with the consequence that most stood on tiptoe or boxes or jumped up and down to converse with him. Hubert, all time craning, straining, cupping his good ear, feigning non-comprehension and muttering, "Pardon? Oh, come again? Please speak up," and etc., at the same time uncontrollably giggling while his hapless companions empurpled and shrieked. Colloquy with Hubert was tough. He put it about that swans were really giant snorkels and that they betrayed dinosaur leviathans gliding cold-eyed beneath the lake. Even suspicious folk and poachers stayed clear of Rawlinson Pond, and on sunny days Hubert went angling, using tufts of his own hair or beard as bait. This he called sassooning. He'd been told that the lake embosomed enormous barbels, and this, translated through his ear trumpet and giggles, became anonymous barbers. He wondered how and why these hairdressers stayed submerged for so long, and was determined to catch one. He spent painstaking afternoons painting maggots with red and white candy stripes, fixing the wiggly horrors stiff with hair lacquer, but it was a waste of time, for white-coated and deep beneath the mirror surface.
Stripe me a pinky, we will never bind. There's been many a close shave, but we slippery on customers stay safely ear cut,
dry and happy.
Down here underwear,
down underwear,
we blow away
punch and poo,
game and set,
like castaway refracted fellow, forget, forget, foe. Would you like to see the back of your head, Rene? My greetings to you. Bye,
bye, bye.
Few of Hubert's activities went unnoticed by PC, given the long arm of the law. He had arrested and formally warned him a few times, especially during Hubert's genital sundial period, but concluded that the poor man got his head screwed unrung, and now turned a blind cheek. Especially since Florrie had had a little chat with him and mentioned the degradation a conviction would bring down on the family. Degradation could only mean the notorious rubber runner, one-eyed Chinese Charlie. And although P.C. Gibbon was himself a West Indian and therefore theoretically a foreigner, he was nonetheless suspicious of Orientals. He leant against his bike, munching a curry goat sandwich and keeping the dormobile home of William Buller Bullethead under surveillance. But he dozed off now and then and thought of the islands and mass and the pans throbbing, lining, smoking. of his training in chill England, and the letters that dribbled sporadically, less and less frequently from Jubilee. The training had been fun. But despite his colour, at 6'5", he was unlike the rest.
A fresh-faced boy in navy blue, shaven and shone with shiny shoes. To all levels, 5'8", the ideal young novitiate. Oh, the morning run is lots of fun, especially if it's raining. We look real sports in our knee-length shorts, it's all part of the training. There's bags of sweat and lots of spanking. Oh, blah, blah,
blah, blah. Lots of spanking is very English, isn't it?
Oh, there's bags of spit and lots of swanking. And bro, my G, to stop you thinking about anything at all.
These happy reminiscings were rudely stopped when Sir Henry, having discarded the unicycle and hidden it, emerged, callid and fuming from Bramble Patch. And at the same time, Buller Bullethead, spruce as a spiv, collided and accosted him.
Hello, Moose, where are you off to? You impertinent lout, you know how I am? Of course not. I could tell you what you look like. What's your moniker? Oh, I'm Sir Henry, Hugh Bliett.
That's nice, I'll remember that. You some kind of artist?
Yes. I'm especially fond of Michael Backlund Jello, the two men responsible for the Sistine Chapel. Mike did the figures, Jello did the setting. Aubrey Mustachio, notorious for his illustration of Chalamet, the Jewish play by Oscar Peterson. Caravaggio, the Gypsy Dauber. Like the moderns too, Jackson Pollock, the Polish abstractionist. Avocado da Vinci and so on. Albrecht Durex, the sensitized German woodcutter, straight round, made a pinhole in every 100 of his editions. Anonymous Bosch, the secret Nazi, Vincent van Rouge, Paul Shazam, the Captain Marvel of post-impressionism, painted nothing but letters, postcards, parcels. Enjoy surrealism, always listen to Mrs. Darley's diary, etc., etc. Anyway, I'm off. I must be off. I'm going to the sewerage farm in Congleton. There to seek inspiration.
What in shit? I mean, you want a gander in my gaff. Family's full of it.
No. This is to do with lumbago.
Is he an artist and all? Hold on, I'll just roll an ollie rag and I'll join him.
No. Approach at your peril. I've got golly, or berry, or trilby.
Listen, Mush, I don't reckon you're a proper sambo at all. For starters, your bacon's a streaky.
What? I decidedly is a sambo, sahib. Regard these earrings.
They look like cotton reels, Chief.
Cotton reels, you lick-spittled toad? These are my ancestral eardrums. Listen, Chuan. I've just sent orders to my cousin, the prince.
Oh, yeah? What for?
Chateau Gratin. That's cat with cheese to you. And Pilar Rice.
Are you elephant's trunk or something?
I'm as sober as a judge, and since I am a magistrate, enjoying fair play and punishment in equal and unflinching severity, I'd advise you to watch your lingo ere I loudly reflect on your parentage, Warner.
Oh, no, I've got you to eat. You ain't no Sambo, you're Sir Henry Rawling me Blinkinsons, aren't you?
Balderdash, I'm humid.
Tell you what, Chief, I'm a man of the world. Don't suppose your type carry any ready bees in your trolley bag, so just make me out of gooses for a monkey and I'll say no more. What is that?
What, you rogue?
Then I can slope down a chapel of rest for a pig's ear and a few mothers.
You resort to knavery? Why, hear me, I have the strength to wrestle mastodons.
Mr. and Mrs. Don's do, Governor. But played a white man squire, I turned clickety-click last Tuesday, done all me dough on the gullies. I'm barassic, honest. Spent a week stretched in front of the Mari Corelli without so much as a gloss.
You marble-hearted female!
Henry raised his cane, then thinking better, turned his back on the lout, pulled up his robe and plucked a ruby from his navel, poked it into Buller's grimy claw, and with a grunt, stumped off. Buller made it to the rubber in moments.
Geezer! What a ginger geezer! I nearly had a seizure when I flopped him in the frog. Spruced up in me piccolo, me tipper and me daisies, bowling down the rubber with me cherry china Fido, roll an oily rag, me cherry bread cheese. You won't add what I see, some geezer. an Uli Ginger geezer, a geezer with a hoocher, I suppose. I really had to rabbit and pork to this geezer. Free freezer, ginger geezer, see you around. Now the ding-dong, yeah. Oh, oh, a diddly oily die, geezer.
Some years previous, Sir Henry, forced to ride side-saddle like Her Majesty because of a painful conan on the Khyber, with his dauntless trained whelk-hounds in pursuit of a vicious servant, determined to apprehend and punish the rascal, fell from his horse near the sewerage works in Concreton. His riding topper blew into the muck, and Henry uncharacteristically ploughed in, high-stepping over the revolving sprinklers to retrieve it. Although unhappy about the odour of the ordure, he found later, to his surprise, considerable relief from his chronic arthritis and lumbago. So now, a monthly visit in disguise, of course, was looked upon with an almost ritual relish. He was back in the passage, and almost to the library's priest-hole secret door. This was the tricky bit. However, the Rawlinson ghost with its ferocious reputation came in handy, if ever Henry was spotted, and his appearance, augmented with howls, sent them all, Mrs. E. included, scurrying. He was musing happily upon this insurance when Henry, to some alarm, noticed a growing phosphorescence in the gloom and discerned, to his horror, a pair of phantom trousers rushing towards him. Next time costs 4 Hail Marys, 3 buttons, and potato crisps are served at communion. So far, Loathsome Gerald has been caught observing the sun through a telescope, and his squint is now permanent. Great Aunt Florrie has gone shopping in Concreton and will be away several hours, as she must stop at the laundrette to thaw out some chickens in the spin dryers. At the same time, Hubert Maynard, in his mid-40s and still unusual, and his brother-in-law, adventurous young Rafe Rawlinson, are playing cricket on Sensible Common. But Rafe has disgraced himself at the crease and stopped the game, and is now alone on the pitch, determined that in atonement he will rid the club of moles. Meanwhile, Hubert and the rest of the team enjoy the break and a chill glass of paraffino in the shade of the pavilion. Now think on it. Dot, 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 dot. Hubert polished his trident with the sleeve of the white pullover carelessly wrapped about his waist. "You could see everything from the top of that bus," he said. "We were in Regent Street, and I was looking right into Broadcasting House. I could see them all running around inside, catching diseases and giggling. My father leant across to me, and he said, 'You'll be in there if you don't stop playing with yourself.'" Through the intestinal smoke of Hubert's pipe, the sweat-spangled face of Reg Smeaton, eyes straining with mad intensity behind glasses the shape of Ford Cortinas, shuddered with the ungovernable maelstrom of information, inessential, infantry and endless, that constituted the grotesque furniture of his mind. Filing cabinets unlocked, thesauri fell agape, Data danced in strict formation. Quick, 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 quick. Puzzles fitted, it all added up. Niggling, self-edited, tumbling with clicking impatience, cross-referenced and erupting, and all gathered berserk fierce, heedless and torrential on his springboard lips. I find that truly engrossing, Hubert Broadcasting, the business of converting sound into electrical impulses, and at a distance to faithfully translate, correct me if I'm wrong, and amplify the listening pleasure of the untold millions approximate. Information, communication, more information. Guglielmo Elmo Marconi, 1874-1937, Italian actor, blogger, populating 280 from the famous Orleans Towers and Pasta. He died of chrysanthemum poisoning, said Hubert sadly. They had to kill all his plants. Did you know he was the real author of A Pictorial History of Gargling? A very great work. Mr. Smeaton, frozen like a red setter, his conversation of the you speak, I wait, you pause, I pounce variety, lent exaggerated ear. They strapped a bloom to his back, and it came up all blotchy. That's why he drank. It was Brasso, mainly. He was a very humble man. Raising high his trident, Hubert struck an odd heroic pose. Paradoxically speaking, I'm rather proud of my humility, a virtue perhaps best embodied in the person of St. Apollonia, martyred in Alexandria, 249 AD. Before this aged Christian lady was consumed by the flames, see combustion, chemical action accompanied by light and heat, her tormentors pulled all her teeth out, her last wishes for a bit of peanut brittle being thus cruelly denied her. This incident is very well attested, and I'm prepared to personally vouch for its veracity. It would take but an instant to hasten back to my shop for a speedy cross-reference for my ever-ready-at-my-fingertips filing system. Look, there's Rafe, he said with rare insight. With practiced effort, Mr. Smeaton behaved outwardly as he knew he must, and screwed his eyes Hong Kong to the distant figure, microscopic and lifelike, shimmering on the pitch. And all this merely token courtesy towards the catatonic Hubert, for in Smeaton's mind the connotations of Rafe, Raffia, Raffle, Sir Stamford, 1781-1826, jostled, assembled, and howled for outlet. He boiled roly-poly puddings in old socks, said Hubert dreamily. But it was the chrysanthemums and Brasso that got to him. In his creamy flannels, Rafe lay atop the molehill like a poultice on a pulsing green boil, trembling to the wild scrabblings of the blind beast beneath his damp stomach. God's teeth, he muttered. If these things bite, one will be singing soprano. He knew that giant African grasshoppers enjoy eating human hair, that rats can't be sick, and that the elephant shrew is without teeth but can give one a nasty suck. However, of the doings of moles, he knew little, save that they made a muck of a cricket pitch. And this stiffened his resolve. In the pavilion, Uncle Hubert and the chaps were looking on. His knuckles whitened as he gripped firm his bat. For them, he had to do this bloody thing. This bloody and necessary bloody thing. And I'm not going to eat it or wear it. Brigitte Bardot will hate me. Perhaps I'll just wear it for a bit. The wind in the willows ruffled the gold hair of a long, long slumbering child within. The wind in the willows, the will in the windows, wails of the widows of furry dark soft, overground, underground, dilipom, comfy and cozy, tuck in for the night. Mummy! My teddy's stopped breathing. Click. It's all right, darling. A great heaving halted this train of thought at the level crossing of rude, heart-stopping panic. Violent shakings, horrid snufflings of Poe's worst imaginings, the brute beast surfaced, snout flailing claws and bristle. Reason fled shrieking from Rafe's thrilling mouth. Aghast, dry-throated, he drank in that which his mind could not comprehend. The thing was grinning with savage glee. Soiled and horrid about its shuddering torso was a capital T-shirt, and in its paw it brandished a microphone. Spasm, abyss, nightmare and swoon, the beckoning void, unsilence and danger. Dan, 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 dan. Dan, 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 dan. Dan, 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 dan. Ah! Dan, dan, dan. Dan 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 dan. Back at the great house, affairs were of a more tranquil stripe. With glass in hand and monocle at ease, Sir Henry Rawlinson, having spent the morning chuckling over the obituaries in the Times, was in expansive mood.
Well, I could play blue football with me back to the table when I was a youngster.
Old Scrotum looked up from the ironing board upon which he was picking the egg and porcupine quills from his master's trousers.
Ah, but these folks be musical, sir.
Sir Henry swatted and stamped on a rather beautiful blue butterfly.
Wop festival? A wop festival, you say? Deuce if I know what those blighters have got to be festive about. I tiddly I tie island for the weekend, eh? Pfft. I can smell those filthy piapsas they eat already.
Scrotum shook three cocktail cherries from the turnips.
I'm saying a couple of the organisers would be popping over a complimentary zone, love.
Henry stiffened his drink.
Well, I'll see him off the premises personally. The hounds are all fagged out from yesterday's Jehovah's Witnesses, and we don't want blood all over the lawns again.
The room darkened as a hang glider passed across the sun.
Seems a novel enough way to commit suicide,
observed Henry.
Pass me my pistol, I'll see if I can't bring him down into the lake.
With a weapon in his charge, the master of Rawlinson End was apt to be very sporting and unpredictable, and the wrinkled retainer took cover behind a leather armchair, peeping through his fingers and clutching a rosary.
What are you doing cowering down there?
Roared Henry. Scrotum tugged furiously at a long-vanished forelock.
Hurry, be out of respect, sir. Well, you're supposed to love me, you vile jelly. Take that.
Mercifully, Henry hit him with the soft end of the pistol. Scrotum sprawled on the parquet flooring. Then, with a kindly pat on the head and a paternal grunt, Henry strode back to the window and took aim at the hang glider, now several hundred yards past the lime trees and fast diminishing. In April sunshine, with the air full of wasps and himself full of pink gins and half a bottle of entre-deux legs, it was an impossible shot. And in a fit of blear-eyed pique, Henry emptied the gun into the tires of a custard yellow van parked in the drive. Like the shock of fondling a raw sausage blindfold at a gay party, the significance of the van was made clear. In a florid scriptiform on the side was painted the following. Nice and tidy, and in brackets, both a right couple of pairs. Just relax and let us do it. And in the right-hand corner, a crude drawing of the masks of tragedy and comedy labelled before and after. The gentlemen owners of this vehicle lodged in the village at the Fool and Bladder and did contract house cleaning, but they purported to be resting theatrical artistes. Both were given to striped blazers, orange pancake, obvious wigs, matching handkerchiefs, shaven legs and musical comedy, which they visited on the drinking fraternity of the Fool and Bladder with unceasing enthusiasm, until, that is, old Seth One-Tooth put a stop to it, claiming,
I'm going as daft as a mahogany frying pan.
Great Aunt Florrie's premise that all musicians were nice people had prompted her to place the music room at Rawlinson End at their disposal, and they confessed themselves to be terribly touched. Henry's reaction to their presence now was primarily of apoplectic astonishment. After all, you don't expect decent folk to take you up on an invitation. It's just downright rudery.
Great thing, he bellowed. Those simpering Nancy boys are in the house. Get up, you stinking blancmange. Quick, go off the piano. Pace it before the...
But it was too late. There were loud theatrical chortles from across the hall, a hint of cologne and...
On stairs, down stairs, wherever we do, we guarantee it will be tickety-boo. You put your feet up or go off to the shops. Just point us at the buckets and mops. Washing up or wiping down, we are the cops. We're
nice and tidy.
We're nice and tidy, tidy and nice.
I'm Teddy Tidy.
And I'm Nigel Nice.
Cleanliness is clearly an obsession we share.
You two will think we're both the right couple of pals. We'll hoover the mats
or neuter your cats.
To you, dear housewife,
we wave our hats.
We'll leave your homes and clinical. Your friends will say that's
nice
and tidy.
That's nice.
This impertinent jollity in the middle of an English afternoon left Sir Henry shivering with a red passion, his eyebrows like limp bats, and his face a crumpled tissue upon which a lobster might well have wiped its bottom.
All crime, he declared, is due to incorrect breathing.
Grim-faced and cold, Henry snatched from the wall the sickle-sharp boar tusks he used for defacing Reader's Digest, and in moments crossed the hall and flung open the doors of the music room.
Startled, Nigel Nice
banjolele held fol-de-rol, minced across the room. Sir Henry, nice to see you, to see you. Henry's glare throttled his hypocrisy at birth.
Do you know what a palmist once said to me? She said, will you let go? Gentlemen, I am a bulldog and you will know my bite is worse.
Teddy Tidy held the piano stool before him. Nigel Nice, in an attempt to look invalid, put on his glasses and blinked. Stamping in frenzy, Henry bellowed the war cry of the Zulu. Ooh, so fool! And adjusting a serviette about his throat, now you squids prepare for wax. Suddenly, a half-thawed chicken caught him in the back of the neck. Next week, Hubert Maynard, ever the gentleman, offers his seat to a lady in a public lavatory. There is considerable misunderstanding. Scalpel aloft with the delicacy and firmness of a man who knows his job. The shaking has stopped, and from the liver bared before the blade to his noble mind pulsed a ligament of concentration. He took a quick breath and made a deep lateral incision, skidding through the resentful tissue, slicing the kidneys, scoring the bacon, and puncturing the fried egg. Unabashed, he watched the yolk pus swell and seep over the sunny side to skate onto the oily blue willow plate. Swab, he barked. Dulcie head-stuffing passed the toast. Munching with surgeon precision, with a forefinger like a bludgeon, he indicated the invitation card, silver-edged and printed in haughty copper plate, which snarled at him from the table. You are asked, it read, to an eating at Rawlinson End, 9 p.m. sharp, RSVP. RSVP? Queried Dulcie head-stuffing. And shall you reponde, if you please? I do not please, sighed the doctor. And the abbreviated letters stand for Rawlinson shall violently punish. He looked mournfully at his wife. You don't have to attend, my dear. They only want me there to man the stomach pump, and I know how much that sickens you. He pecked her an antiseptic kiss on the cheek. Tired as he was, his suit was still clean-cut as cheese slices, and the morning's surgery had been unusually heavy, at least 50 villagers suffering from Sir Henry's blemish. Was the custom, since old Sir Hilary Rawlinson's cheerful time, to reward the serfs with a Christmas florin. There was an arrow slit in the back wall of the great house, through which the happy peasants traditionally thrust their hands to receive the kindness. This benevolence was in no way assumed by kindly Sir Henry, but with one novelty. He ordered the coins made red hot in the stove. This made the bounty less fun to receive, and it was ruffian Dick Gruffly who hit on the idea of wearing mittens. Immediately, Henry imposed a glove tax of 2 and 3, reasoning, on the one hand, a small profit, and in the other, at least some screaming to brighten the season of good cheer. But all too soon the mark became the stigmata of heroes, and at Christmas, to wear a hand free of Sir Henry's blemish showed a weak heart, notwithstanding some business sense, for Dr. Headstuffing charged a toss a room for his soothing salve. So it set you back a tenner to display daring. At Rawlinson End, much of a postcard Christmas, it wasn't. No jolly coachloads, horses grinning at the bit, no crack of whips and heavy-coated Robin Goodfellows bringing the British sherry over the ice. Above a charcoal stickscape of wish-wash and rain hues, clouds like a cough hawked, threatening big spits and awful gobbing and any amount of unseasonal nasty. And this sky had teeth and gripped Rawlinson in dreadful jaws of frost. Hubert heard it.
The cracks are showing, the cracks are showing. Listen to the loonies crooning, while the man in the moon that they left behind is rising in the east. Hey, ha, ho, the way things are, the clocks are baring their teeth. Grandfather stopped, time for time to flash out as a leaf inches. Hey, ha, ho, the way things are, the cracks are showing, the cracks are showing, the cracks are.
But preparations for the eating were well underway. In the grounds, deep trenches were dug, with poles slung across, and a choice of news or sandpaper. And logs were hewn for the great bonfire by the lake. In the house, commodes, poles, potties, and discreet piles of sawdust were dumped at strategic places in deference to the vast excretion and deluge of waste product to come. All this clanking, chopping and whistling made something of a dent in Sir Henry's slumber edition of Africa. An insect wire whine, both horizontal and insistent in the nigritude of cranial self, bone cavern of limitless egos, ears resisting epaulettes on the id, but noisy, crashing intelligences found sphincter exit like cracked worms.
Mind you, I spared the poor beast from the endangered species list. I shot them. They're extinct.
For Sir Henry, waking up was not a welcome way of beginning the day.
Camped in the shadow of those old fierce gods, campfires seem to make them dance.
Henry yawned like a woman stretching, bleary eye on tiptoe to Tadanus.
And then the golden stool of the Ashanti. Had to run for it.
Mrs. E appeared in the doorway.
Did I hear you mention stools, dear?
What?
Henry writhed in the halfness of now.
You see, I can tell a lot by looking. They should float, dear, your movements.
How can I move? Shrapnel, bayonets, spear, poisoned arrows. What?
Breakfast, dear, sniffled the housekeeper. Fried or fried?
Bring me meat burned like St. Joan and vicious mustards to pierce the tongue like Cardigan's lances,
roared Henry.
May God make you fart! Get out!
Mrs. E withdrew like an embittered snail. Henry ruefully examined his body, bruised from a rather clumsy night of the night before. It was then he noticed at the base of his stomach great swaddled hillock, what appeared pitched a perky, throbbing tent. This was so unusual he at first feared rigor mortis, but Madame Memory's five lovely daughters jerked him to rhinoceros attention. With gawping incredulity, nothing in the fetid tunnels of his body did he more abhor. He snatched her a riding crop,
and thrashed his impertinent member into limp submission. It was then that he heard the creaking and the heavy feet of eventful Humbert. Dead Humbert. Henry woke up proper and cold.
Humbert, Humbert. Humbert, Humbert, how can he go out now? Henry doesn't care a toss. Wowzers, jodpers, easy breezes. Anything he comes across. Up jumped the trousers and they ran around the guests. At least they didn't make a smell. That geese be blessed. Oh, looking for your strides. If you barbecue, your varmint's chops will side.
Next time, swine money. And you will know why Henry shot his brother and how the ghost of Humbert got laid.
As though it could be frightfully insensitive. That's Viv Stanshall and Goose Flesh Steps Part 1. Our thanks to you to Peter Moss, piano, double bass, violin, mandolin and backing vocals, and John Kirkpatrick, accordion, concertina, jew's harp and backing vocals. And after all of that, a cure.
Thank you.